The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 53. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hi, guys. So, getting right into the chats, guys. Tons of stuff to talk about. And I see Chadism is here. Thank you, my friend. It's good to see you all the time. Should I sell a condo in LA that's $350,000 rents for, oh my gosh. No, sell. Well, let me be clear. Oh, let me scroll up here. Chadism, let me, again, this isn't investment advice. I'm just telling you what I would do personally. And it all depends on your personal situation. And there's a thousand different variables. But if I was just looking at it as an investment, and this doesn't take into consideration capital gains and all the other variables, but I would take that equity, assuming you got 100% equity, excuse me, and I would roll it over into a linear market where your RV ratio is going to be a lot higher and you got a lot less downside. I think the argument for owning in LA or one of these cyclical markets is that you'll have a lot more appreciation, but going into a recession, if not a depression that we have with the Cerveza sickness, that benefit is pretty much off the table. So I'd start looking at the downside a lot more. I don't know if you could sell it right now. I don't think prices have come down. Probably not a lot of sellers, not a lot of buyers, but I would prefer to have that equity somewhere else in a more linear market with less downside. Okay, Marcos, thank you for the super chat. Hi, George. Hope you are good. I'm well. Thank you. I think I know where all the ventilators that are New York needs, the Fed using them to keep the S&P alive. I mean, from a health standpoint, I really shouldn't be laughing at that, but that's a good one. Yeah, that's for sure. Okay, Niels, thank you for the super chat. What do you think about investment grade jewelry? It has a major tax benefit, little risk of confiscation. I like it. I like it a lot, especially if you're someone that's, we're all on kind of a spectrum, if you will. And I'm not talking about how you identify. I haven't gone off the political deep end yet, but no, as far as the spectrum of how concerned you are about government confiscation of your precious metals. And a lot of people, and I don't think there's any right or wrong, it's an individual opinion. A lot of people are really concerned about confiscation because what the UK government, the United States government, the Australian government, a lot of governments have done in the past. So if you're one of those people that's super concerned about that, where you're losing sleep, I think that's a fantastic alternative, because I did a video on this a few weeks ago and I researched it for a couple hours. I could not find any instance where a government had taken the jewelry. Even in Italy with Mussolini, it was, well, according to what I read, it was kind of a volunteer type thing where you'd give them your gold and they'd give you like a little bracelet that says, I support the government or whatever it said. I think that's a great way to go if you're really concerned about those risks. And, you know, honestly, I think even if you're not that concerned, I'd still do it with maybe a percentage, because let's say you got 100 grand in precious metals and gold, physical. I mean, would it be a real bad idea to have 5 grand or 10 grand in like a necklace where you could just hop on a plane and just peace out and they're not going to bother you? You just look like Mr. T or something like that. I think that's a smart idea. You know, your downside is you pay a bit of a premium, but I think you sleep better at night. Okay, Chadism, thank you for the super chat. What to do with the cash? When do we invest back in? I just put the cash into, depends on how much you've got, Chad. Well, assuming you've got 100% equity in that, in your last question, I'd put it into T-bills. I'd roll it over. I don't think they're negative yielding anymore. So bonus, right? Because I think you've got a little bit more than is FDIC insured. If you had like 100, I probably wouldn't be too worried about that being in the bank, especially if your bank is a small community bank where you know them well and you've had a chance to look at what their loan book did back in 2007 or 2008-09. But even if you're over that, you know, is FDIC going to get bailed out? They don't have the funds, but they'd most likely be bailed out. I mean, it's a give and take with everything, but I'd probably just put it into 3-month T-bills and just roll them over. And what I'd do is I'd look for real estate, but I'd look for opportunities in the interim. So if you can find, I'm not saying that the whole market is going up or down. I'm actually going to do another video on the real estate market tomorrow for you guys. The one I did last Monday was super, super popular. So I'm going to try to take it down just to a basic level, not even really a real estate investor level, more of, hey, I'm just the average Joe. I own a house, or I'm thinking about buying a house. Should I wait? You know, what do you think home prices are going to do in the future? Just kind of a very basic level. And so I'm going to try to do that in tomorrow's video. But the point is that if you can find a motivated seller and get a home or an investment property at 2012 prices, it doesn't really matter where the market is. It's all a function of the price of the individual asset you're considering. It's just like stocks. The market could be in a massive bubble, but if you could somehow find a stock that was super cheap, historically speaking, at a very low, like oil as an example right now, it may be an interesting way to dip your toe into the market. And it's all a function of price. Marcelo, thank you for the super chat. Hello, George. For the past 6 years, I've been watching real estate bubble here in Vancouver, Canada. Yeah, I was in Macro Voices Live with my buddy Eric Townsend last year. And man, the taxi driver was telling me about the prices there, everything we drove by. And I was blown away. Canadian household debt is the largest among G7 countries. Do you think that this monster bubble will finally pop? Yeah. Yeah, I do. I don't see how it doesn't, other than you might not have a lot of sellers because people just want to hang on to it. I don't see how it doesn't deflate, Marcello. Nothing's certainty. I would love to hear an argument for a rational argument for how the prices could kind of remain elevated, but I don't think so. Same thing with Australia. It's just, everyone's going to have to deal with the cerveza sickness. And if that's shutting down the economy, I mean, how are Canadians going to make those payments? The only thing is, if let's just say 70% of the housing market was owned outright, where the buyers just paid cash, that might be a little different because no one really has to sell because no one has a mortgage payment. That's like Colombia. Very few people here have mortgages. They own their properties outright. So, but I don't think it's that way. Although I know there's a lot of Chinese investors and foreign investors there that paid with cash. I don't know that that's more than 20%. So if you got 80% of the market that is going to be in a pinch, that's going to affect the market for sure. Mark, thank you for the super chat. Should I pay off my house instead of cash in the bank? Assuming that you've got a 30-year fixed rate loan, Mark, I would pay off your house. I think that's a great way to short the dollar. Assuming that you're not overly concerned about your job. I mean, I'm making a lot of assumptions here, but assuming that you're pretty confident you can continue to make your mortgage payment, I wouldn't pay it off because I'm assuming you've got a super low interest rate. Historically speaking, let's call it 4%. Just remember that if inflation goes above 4%, the delta is a transfer of wealth from the lender to you because you're paying the loan back with cheaper devalued dollars. So just to give you an idea of how this would work, let's take it to an extreme. Let's say that your house is worth $500,000 or your loan balance is $500,000. Let's just say that we wake up in 3 months and we've had just massive hyperinflation to where $500 will now just buy you a loaf of bread. In other words, you in 3 months, in this hypothetical, you could pay off your entire home loan with the same amount of money as you would pay for a loaf of bread. That's a wealth transfer. Basically, you're getting it for free. So that means the value of the house that you own still can buy goods and services, and hopefully could buy close to the same amount of goods and services in 3 months after this hyperinflation imaginary scenario here we're talking about. So hopefully it could buy the same amount of goods and services in 3 months that it could buy now. The big difference is you're basically paying it off with a loaf of bread in 3 months. So the difference between the amount of goods and services that you could buy for $500,000 now compared to 3 months, that's a transfer of wealth to you from the bank. So that's why I like hanging on to a super, super cheap fixed rate debt, assuming you can service it. So Jan, thank you for the super chat. Why do you view silver as speculative? It historically has always lagged gold and outperformed. Yeah, but just look at your question. I think you answered it in your question, Jan. Because you're looking at silver as well. I shouldn't say that. Maybe you're not looking at a way to actually increase purchasing power. The reason I see it as a speculative asset, because it's not, the supply side of silver is different than gold, in the sense that there's very few pure silver miners. And this is, if you want more in-depth analysis on this, Rick Rule walked me through this whole concept and how this works on my interview with him maybe a couple months ago. So definitely check that out. But so there can be a lot of supply of silver hitting the market when, because they're mining other things and the silver is a byproduct, where gold is more of a pure play. Also, a lot of the demand for silver comes through industrial use. So if we have industrial down due to a supply shock, demand shock, whatever, with the coronavirus or the Cerveza sickness, I got to catch myself there with the Cerveza sickness, then you could see the demand drop on that side of the equation while the demand increases on the other side due to holding it because you think that we're going to experience some inflation. So I'm not saying it's bad. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that it couldn't be a good insurance play. I'm just saying I like gold better. And for me, the insurance bucket is always just physical gold. Conrad, thank you for the super chat. 4 years of housing prices to drop, 4+ years. Yeah. What's your gut say about California percentage drops? Will it happen sooner in the market? Thank you. You rock. Appreciate the kind words, Conrad. Well, I'm trying to. Yeah. The reason I would say yes, most likely, and who knows, but most likely yes, because the RV ratios are so low in California, and I'm talking about the major markets, LA, San Francisco, that a lot of the investors there that own these properties are cash flow negative on a monthly basis. If you're cash flow negative on a monthly basis and you lose renters or there's no appreciation, you're in a real bad spot, super bad spot. And if you have the price to income ratio at such an extreme, meaning the monthly mortgage payment would most likely occupy a larger percentage of that person's take-home pay, there's going to be additional pressure if the job losses increase substantially, which they most likely will, especially if you go back and look at the jobless claims last week of 6.6 million. That's on top of the 3.3 the week prior. Just to give you some context, at the height of the GFC in 2008, 2009, we were around 600,000. So that's not good. We've never seen anything like this in the job market before. So takeaway, I think there is probably a chance where the home prices in California drop faster. But there again, the Fed could come in and just buy all the mortgages through the mortgage-backed securities or sausages, the mortgage-backed sausages. I need to get to the other questions. This is a fantastic question, Conrad. I think if I'm on the fence because of what the Fed can do and what the government could do, but excluding that, I think definitely from a fundamental standpoint, the prices would go down faster. Yes. And just to reiterate, tomorrow's video, I'm going to be talking all about this. I'm not going to be looking at it really from an investor standpoint or RV ratios, just really a homeowner, just the average Joe and Jane. I'm going to be looking at it from what's going on right now, the stimulus package and how that applies to homeowners, and then how I see prices playing out in real terms over the long run. And I'm going to get into the nitty-gritty of that. Andres, thank you for the super chat. Do you think we are headed to financial system reset? If so, how would that look on the other side? It really depends on how you define a financial system reset. I definitely think when we get to the other side of this next recession, regardless or depression, regardless of how long it takes, things are going to be different. I think in the next 3 years, we'll most likely have a government-backed digital currency. I think they're going to try to ban cash. I think you're going to have a less dynamic economy because there's going to be much more government involvement. I think we're going to have a lot fewer personal freedoms and liberties. I think we're going to have negative real GDP. I don't know whether that's, or maybe flat. I don't think we're going to have much GDP growth adjusted for inflation. I want to make sure I'm very, very clear. We definitely could have nominal GDP growth, but I see kind of a lost decade, even at the very best, a lost year, two, probably 3 years. So much of the consumption in the United States is predicated upon asset prices. That's why the Fed is so intent on keeping asset prices high and keeping this bubble inflated, the everything bubble. You can look at it this way. If the majority of the population are baby boomers and they are retiring, if their 401k or their investments in the stock market take a 50% haircut and they lose 50% of the equity in their home, which is most people, if you combine those two things, that's the majority of their net worth. How does that affect their consumption for the rest of their lives? Because they're not going to go back in. It's not like they're 20, 30 years old, 40 years old, where if they lose half of their net worth, they can just try to buy the market again and hope over the next 20 years it gets back up to where it was, or 10 years or whatever. It just doesn't work that way. So you've got to put yourself in the position of someone who's 70 years old, let's say, and let's say you had $1 million portfolio or net worth from a standpoint of $500,000 in the market and maybe $500,000 in equity in your house, and that goes down to 500 grand. That's a big hit. That's a lot less spending you're going to be doing moving forward. And you're going to probably most likely have to go back into the job market. So that squeezes out the younger people who might have less experience. There's more competition for lower end jobs, more government involvement, more monopolies, less startups, less capital to invest in technology or startups in general. Let's think this through. If over the last 12 years since 2008, if the Fed would not have artificially manipulated interest rates and let's just say rates would have been at 5%, which sounds insane right now, but we just look back before 2008 and it was just, that was just normal. So if Fed funds was at 5%, if a 10-year treasury was paying 6 or 7%, if corporate bonds were paying a lot more, you know, if the Fed funds was the bottom and you had a normal yield curve, how many of the businesses that we know today would have ever been funded or would be in business right now? I mean, let's be honest. You think Tesla would be in business? No. And I'm not saying they've got bad cars. I'm not saying they're not going to be the future, and they could be. That's a completely separate video. But they wouldn't be in business right now because they never would have been funded. Same thing with Grubhub and WeWork. And I mean, I could go down the list. But so do those companies exist on a moving forward basis if we don't have super cheap money that's going further and further and further and further out the risk curve trying to chase yield? So it looks a lot different. And I think my base case, not that I'm right or wrong, I mean, I'm just some crazy guy on YouTube that almost flunked out of high school and has never taken an econ class in his life. So take it for what it's worth. But I just see low growth, no growth in real terms, maybe negative growth. And while you have inflation, so a little bit different than China or than Japan in the sense that they had no growth, but kind of a deflationary period. I think we have a little bit of inflation or maybe the 70s stuff. But in real terms, we have negative GDP growth. I know I took a long time on that one, guys. Sorry to get behind, but it's just very important that we think all these things through because there's just a lot of cross currents at play. FR Kiddo, thank you for the super chat. Keep it up. Yes, you've got a pair that's looks like he's doing curls. I wish I could do that right now. I can't go to the gym. I can't leave the damn apartment. J6, thank you for the super chat. SDO or TZA. SDOW or TZA. Anyone short the indexes? I'd be very hesitant going short. I'm not sure what those tickers are, Jay, but I'd be very concerned going short outright because the Fed can come in and just buy everything. And I think they're just going to break the rules. They're going to change the rules just to try to prop everything up. And instead of being the lender of last resort, I think they're going to be the buyer of last resort. And so I would be hesitant to short anything. But again, that's me personally. That's, you could be an expert at that and maybe pull it off a lot better than I could. The Argonautics, thank you for the super chat. I'm planning to diversify the insurance part of the portfolio, only gold so far. What do you think about things like Bitcoin, silver, platinum? Okay, so to me, there's nothing is insurance except for gold. Gold's, that's it. Not even paper gold, just physical gold. That's insurance. So it's not that I don't like Bitcoin, silver, or platinum. It's just, in my opinion, those are not insurance. It doesn't mean you shouldn't buy them. Those are speculations. And platinum, I think platinum's pretty expensive right now. So I hate to buy something when it's not cheap. But I don't know that. But as far as Bitcoin, I like Bitcoin as a speculation because there's so much asymmetry. Silver, I've talked about that. I really like it because it's so darn cheap right now, but I like it as a speculation. So me personally, I wouldn't try to diversify the insurance side of my portfolio because there's only one option. I just wouldn't have it 30, 40, 50% of my portfolio. I only have it as 10%. Marcos, thank you for the super chat. It seems every dollar the Fed puts to keep the stock market alive goes out instantly. It actually looks like a huge transfer of money for friends and insiders. How long can they keep it up? Let's see, Marcos, that's a great question. I'm just trying to think how I can explain it in one simple, fast step. Because this is tough to explain. I really want to encourage everybody to understand or try to better understand how the Fed creates money and or how they print money. We all know they're not literally printing up pieces of paper. That's just a kind of a saying. So when they quote unquote print money, although the money they print is denominated in dollars, it's kind of not dollars. It's bank reserves. So to say that the Fed, if you're saying the Fed prints money and increases the money supply at the same time, as though they're synonymous, that's not actually true. And if you do that, then you kind of start to make mistakes in your thinking. Because as of, well, now it's kind of all bets are off, but as of 3 weeks ago, the bank reserves, I want you to think of them as Dave and Buster tokens that have a value of $1. So if there's a video game at Dave and Buster's that costs $1 to play it, if you put in one of your $1 Dave and Buster tokens, then you can play the video game. And Dave and Buster's can create as many $1 Dave and Buster tokens as it wants for the people who are playing games at Dave and Buster's, okay? Well, Dave and Buster's is the Fed. And the people that come into Dave and Buster's are the primary dealers. They're the ones that have the reserve accounts held at the Fed. So when the Fed prints up money, they're printing up Dave and Buster tokens to buy assets from the people who come into Dave and Buster's. Okay, the primary dealers. But in order for those Dave and Buster tokens to get out into the real economy, meaning outside of Dave and Buster's, the people that are in Dave and Buster's that go there, that have the Dave and Buster tokens, they have to exchange them at the door for dollar dollars, and then they take their dollar dollars and go out into the real economy, go to the grocery store, go buy gas, pay their phone bill, pay their rent, etc. Okay. So my point is the people in Dave and Buster's, they have to take those tokens, they have to kind of exchange them and do something in order for those tokens to get out into the real economy. It's the exact same way with the Fed. So when they print money, it's bank reserves. The bank reserves just go from bank to bank to bank. So even if you've got Goldman Sachs that buys $1 billion worth of treasuries from JP Morgan, the money doesn't get out into the real economy. It's not growing the money supply because it's just a transfer from Goldman Sachs account with the Fed, their bank reserves, to JP Morgan's bank reserves. The money never leaves the balance sheet of the Fed. It never expands, right? So the primary dealers or the banks under the Fed's umbrella that have accounts with them, if it's just going from bank to bank, the money supply doesn't increase. Base money does. Dave and Buster tokens do, but real dollars don't. So if JP Morgan makes a loan to you for $1 billion, if they loan Marcos $1 billion, then yeah, the money supply increases and they could have more lending power because they've got more reserves to back up those loans. You see? Or if JP Morgan, let's say Marcos, you have $1 billion worth of mortgage-backed sausages. If JP Morgan wants to buy your mortgage-backed sausages with excess reserves that they have, then yes. Then what happens is those reserves go to, let's say you're with Wells Fargo, the $1 billion of reserves goes from JP Morgan's account to Wells Fargo account, and the new $1 billion worth of deposits go into your checking account at Wells Fargo, bam, now all of a sudden there's $1 billion of real dollars in the system where there otherwise wouldn't. That's the transfer mechanism there, right? So I want to make sure that everyone really understands that thoroughly. Going back to your question, I got off track there. Okay, right. So it looks like a huge transfer of money for friends and insiders. Kind of. It all depends on what the primary dealers do. I think if you look at their four-letter programs, the alphabet soup programs they've come out with recently, Marcos, that's more of a huge transfer of money to friends and insiders, because now what the Fed is doing is they're buying assets directly from the private sector who don't have reserve accounts held at the Fed, in which case that is creating additional money supply with those bank reserves. So I again, the takeaway here is if they're doing it just intra-bank, the Fed, if they're just buying assets from other banks that already have accounts with them, they're not growing the money supply in the real economy. If they start buying things from the private sector or entities that don't have reserve accounts, then they are increasing the money supply. And so that's the way I'd kind of look at it. Really need a whiteboard for that one. All right, Bennett, thank you for the super chat. Hey, George, nice job on RT America. Appreciate it, Bennett. That was a lot of fun. If you guys don't know, the other day, I think Thursday maybe, I was on RT Television, RT America with Rick Sanchez. He does their primetime news, I guess. And it was about 5 o'clock. He had me on there live to talk about the Fed. And I followed Jesse Ventura, who I'm a huge fan of because I used to love WWE and WWF. So I used to watch Jesse the Body Ventura. So, and I didn't know I was following him. So when I was, you kind of see it on the screen there, you're watching it in advance or who he's talking to before you come on. And I saw Jesse the Body, so that was really cool. But yeah, thank you very much. And if you guys want to watch my appearance there, I think I put a link up on my Twitter feed. So check my Twitter feed last week, and you'll see a link that you can watch. You can watch it on YouTube or something. Any suggestions on investments denominated in more solvent currencies? Yeah. There's very few solvent currencies, Bennett. That's the problem, buddy. Also, thoughts on Dragon portfolio from Chris Cole. Well, Chris Cole is one of the smartest dudes out there. So if you're talking about his long-term portfolio where he adds volatility into it, I'm a huge fan. I think that would be fantastic. Unfortunately, I think that gets pretty complicated. I don't know that for sure because I haven't researched it extensively, but it just, if my memory serves me right from listening to that episode, I think it's a little more complex than might be. It might be a little complex for the average Joe is what I'm trying to say. So, but for those out there, definitely listen to the episode of Macro Voices with Chris Cole and understand the concepts he's talking about. And maybe that's within your wheelhouse. Give it a shot. But I definitely think it's valid, and I'm a huge fan of Chris Cole and, of course, Macro Voice. Oh, he did it on Real Vision. I'm sorry. I didn't see his bit on Real Vision. I know he discussed the exact same thing on Macro Voices with my buddy Eric Townsend. So that's what I was referring to. So watch it on Real Vision or Macro Voices. As far as solvent currencies, man. I mean, the problem is the dollar could go to 120, 130. Outside the United States, there's such a shortage of dollars. I guess if it's a long-term play, Bennett, if you could get some cheap stocks in like Singapore, denominated in Singapore dollars, I would. Actually, I think that's probably what I'd do, because I'm assuming, I haven't looked at a chart lately. I used to go to Singapore all the time, but I'm not sure what the Singapore dollar is right now. but assuming that it's kind of cheap historically, going back to like 2011, 2012, I think, and you could get some cheap stocks there, maybe because of what's going on with the Cerveza sickness. I have no idea what their, if their market's up, down. I haven't looked at it, but I'd probably start there. And I hate to say anything in Europe because it's so volatile right now. And I like long-term Asia. Long-term, I mean 10 plus years. So I think that would be the place where I'd start, Singapore. Okay, Anderson, thank you for the super chat. In the inflation years in Brazil, we rushed to the stores, spent all our money the day we got paid. Yeah. Otherwise, it'd be worthless the next day. Is that the kind of inflation you envision in the United States? I think it's possible. I don't think it's possible in the short term. I think once the dollar is no longer the reserve currency, Anderson, I think that's what you're going to see, because you're going to have all those dollars come flooding back into the United States, and the Feds most likely won't be able to raise interest rates. And it's just, I think, now it doesn't mean that we go into Venezuela, but I think you could see prices going up 20, 30, 40% per year in the United States. But I don't want to really sound the alarm bell too heavily on that, because although I do think that's a possibility, I don't really see that as a reality or even a high probability for like 3-5 years. So, it's definitely a possibility, especially with as much base money is being created and MMT and how much the money supply is going to grow. Additionally, how the global supply chains could be disrupted to the standpoint of we might not be able to import many things. We'd have to produce most of what we consume in the United States. That means prices would really go up, especially if we've got MMT that's creating more dollars in the system, chasing fewer goods and services. So I'm not saying Venezuela there, but I am saying 10, 20% inflation per year, which would, although that people might not go out and buy things that day, they definitely want to buy things that week or that month. Rocky, thank you for the super chat. CARES Act allows you to withdraw from your 401k without a penalty. I moved my S&P position to cash in late 19. Didn't take a hit. I'm 30 and rather pay taxes now and use money to invest now. Thoughts? I don't know how much you took out, Rocky. I don't know how much of a tax hit you took, but I think that was a pretty darn smart move. I think you're probably very happy you did that right now, Rocky. My thoughts are pretty much the same as I tell people now. I told people 3 months ago, prior to the Cerveza sickness. And it's all about just buying what's cheap. And per my video the other day, just because the market gets cheap, let's say it goes down to where on the CAPE ratio, we're under 15. That doesn't necessarily mean that the individual asset, whether it's real estate, stock, company that you're buying is cheap, right? So you got to look at kind of what I like to do is take a tops down approach. I like to look at the broad macro and just kind of go down, 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 and like an inverted pyramid until, okay, it's kind of, is the broad macro cheap? Okay, great. Check, 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 check. And now I've got higher probabilities of that investment or speculation working out. But to be very clear, the market could be incredibly expensive, like the housing market, let's just say, because it's a lot more inefficient. So it's much more likely in the housing market and real estate. We could be at all-time highs, 2006, 2019, and you could still get a smoking deal and you could still find something that's cheap. It all depends on the seller. If you find a super, super motivated seller that just has to have liquidity tomorrow for whatever reason, you could get a 2012 deal in 2019. So it isn't necessarily about the broad market. So I don't want to get too fixated on that point, but that is where I start, right? So I think it's good to look at everything. So my thoughts are just keep your powder dry and look for things that are cheap. If you want to get into real estate, I wouldn't just dive right into the first thing that you see. Just I've talked about it in several other videos. If you want to get in the market, I would just, if you can find something that's super cheap, like I bought coal the other day. I'm not saying to buy it. I'm just saying I bought it because it's super, super cheap. So that's kind of how I would address it for my own portfolio. Evgeny, hopefully I'm pronouncing that right. Thank you for the super chat. Hi, George. Waves of gratitude from Moscow. When do you think it's a perfect time to buy gold, silver? In what period of time do those funny money go to real economy causing massive inflation? You can never predict the timing of those things at all. You can you can understand the underlying fundamentals, but the timing, it's impossible to know. Because so much of inflation or deflation is psychological. And how do you get a read on that for an entire population of 330 million people that are executing billions of transactions on a daily basis? It's tough. And I don't want to say that inflation is 100% psychological, but in my opinion, that's a big component of it. So it's just smart to analyze the fundamentals and go from there. So the perfect time for me to buy gold is whenever I have more money. The price or timing is irrelevant. So let's say I sell one of my real estate deals and I pocket $100,000. Regardless of the price, regardless of the timing, I'm going to take $10,000 and I'm going to buy gold. It's just bam, done. No, it's not even, you don't think about it. As far as silver, because I see it as a speculation, that would be different. I think silver is cheap right now. So if I was buying it for a 10-year speculation, I would definitely consider it. But again, I think we've got to compartmentalize the two precious metals there. Zach, thank you for the super chat. I just finished watching your video about gold confiscation. You mentioned offshore vaults. Stay away from Perth. Can you recommend any specific ones? I haven't used any of them, Zach, so I can't recommend them from personal experience. I would look into the Canadian Mint. I would assume, and I don't know this for sure, I would assume that they have storage as an option for the consumer. If my memory serves me right, that's where Rick and Rick Rule and Sprott keep the gold for their gold fund is in the Canadian Mint. So I'd probably start there. I'd look at somewhere in Asia because Asia is a lot different than the East is a lot different from the West in the way they view gold. So gold confiscation would be, in my opinion, would be a lot harder in a place like Singapore because of the way the culture views gold. So I think Singapore and Canada would be where I would start. And not only that, I've lived in Singapore kind of for 6 months at a time here and there. It's 3-6 months at a time. And I just know the overall attitude there with the government is very, very, well, let me just put it this way. I would have a hard time seeing the Singaporean government come in and confiscate gold. Andre, thank you for the super chat. Oil up or down in the next 2 weeks? Oh, who knows? I don't know. Next 2 weeks, nobody knows. I know that we're in contango in the sense that the spot price is a lot lower than the future price. But I'm not an oil expert by any stretch of the imagination. I would listen to my buddy Eric Townsend at Macro Voices. Check him out on Twitter, Art Berman. I would ask those or look for some advice from those guys. Now, is it up in 2 years? Then I can start to give you advice or at least my opinion with some level of confidence. And in 2 years, I think it'll be up. Ron, thank you for the super chat. I'm buying an apartment once the building is fully built. Okay. Okay, so I'm assuming like a, maybe a condo or an apartment. Yeah, we call it that outside the United States. I'm torn between paying it upfront or loan to make good use of low rates, 6%. Oh, I see. You're in Romania. Okay. I'm sorry. Your name is Rob. Ugh, forgive me, Rob. 6% fixed rate for 7 years in Romania. Variable after that. Yeah, see, you guys don't, correct me if I'm wrong, don't have the 30-year fixed rate mortgage. That's actually something that's almost exclusive to the United States because it's subsidized. It depends on your financial situation, Rob, and how stable you are, how stable your income is. If you've got quite a bit of savings and you've got a real stable income that, and you're not too reliant upon the economy, I would go ahead and keep the powder dry. I'd take out the loan. Yeah, I would do that because then at the end of the day, let's say the market goes back up to 30,000 tomorrow and there was nothing cheap to buy. Well, fine. Then you just take the money that you had, the dry powder, and you just go ahead and pay out the loan. You got some initiation fees and whatnot with the loan, but then just pay it down. You can always do that. And then if in 3 or 6 months, whatever, if the market goes back down to 40, 50% market cap to GDP, if you can get some, if the market goes, let's say under 10 on the Cape, not that it will, but let's just say that it did, then I think it would, I personally, assuming that you're financially very, very stable, I would rather have that money in a dividend stock that was paying me 10, 12% that I could get it under a 10 PE that was a real nice blue chip than just having the equities tied up in my house, really not making me any money. Wally, thanks for the super chat. Congrats on your debut on RT. I appreciate it, buddy. Do you know Stephen Van Metre? No, I do not. He is an expert on the bond market. I'd love for you to interview him if possible. Okay, I'll look him up. If, let's see, Sebastian, why don't, just do me a favor and write down this gentleman's name, please. Financial Fortune, thank you for the super chat. Is uranium about to go to all-time highs with all the mines closed, surveys of sickness, utilities renewing long-term contracts from 2007? I have no idea if it's going to all-time highs. No one does. The only thing I can do right now is tell you if it's cheap. And historically speaking, it's cheap. And if you listen to my last interview, the part two with Chris McIntosh from Capitalist Exploits, we really go into uranium and I try to push back and give him some counter arguments so he can just really express the how detailed his thoughts are on this topic. And I think he does a good job of that. So if you're interested in uranium, make sure that you check out that last interview I did with Chris McIntosh. It's the part two. And then I know he's just done a ton of homework on it. Marcello, thank you for the super chat. Hey, George, thanks for answering my previous question. Now, what do I do with my Canadian maple dollars? Thank you and keep up the fantastic work. Canadian maple dollars. Well, I'm not sure that I'd really do anything. I don't know that there's much to do there, if I'm understanding you right, Marcello. I think one of the best lessons for investing was taught by Jim Rogers. I remember in his interview with Jack Schwager, who did the Market Wizard books, and this interview must have been done in the late 80s or early 90s, the way Jim Rogers described his investment strategy is he said he just does nothing. He says it's the hardest thing to do, and it's often your best move. Just do nothing. And he says, I just wait and sit. And he says, then when I see some money laying over in the corner, all I do is I just go and pick it up. And then I go back and do nothing. And it's what I love about Jim Rogers so much is he puts things, he just simplifies things down to its just core. This is what you need to know. And anything else is just kind of nonsense. And I think we tend to, and myself included, we intend to overcomplicate things to an extreme. And if we can just get down to the basics. And so what would be an example of just sitting and doing nothing and just waiting till you see some money over in the corner and just going to pick it up? Well, if I'm not saying they're going to, but let's just say that the CAPE ratio gets down under 10 and you can buy Apple at a 10% dividend yield or something. Okay, that would, in my opinion, that would be just finding a pile of money in the corner and just going to pick it up. Or let's say you could, I'm not saying this will happen, but let's say a house, a really in a great neighborhood, all the numbers make sense, and you can buy it for half price, half of what you could buy it for 3 months ago, let's say in a year. And it's under, and remember the chart I always use, guys, is the housing prices adjusted for inflation and size going all the way back to 1900 or even the late 1800s. And you guys know there's just that line that's right average, right all the way across. And in 2006, when we came crashing down to a bottom in 2012, we bottomed right at the historic mean. So if you got to a point where you could buy at a level under that historic mean and get a 1.5, 2% RV ratio, who knows what's going to happen in the future? To me, that would be another example of just finding some money and going in the corner and picking it up. But right now, going into like and buying Wells Fargo as an example at a 7% dividend yield, I don't know. That's maybe a little more speculative. I don't know if I'd categorize that as just money laying in the corner. So that's the best advice that I can give you via Jim Rogers. Farrell, Android, thank you for the super chat. Do you think we'll have a second wave of infection once current lockdowns are done? Will there be a second lockdown? Yeah, I do. Yeah, unfortunately. Because you've got to get up to herd immunity, and people they're still comparing the cervasis sickness to the flu. And even if they're right, as far as the case fatality rate and the serious complication rate, the component they're not really thinking about is the R0 value, how fast it spreads. And they're not thinking about the fact that the majority of Americans and people in the world, for that matter, have a certain degree of immunity for the flu. So, and I understand it mutates and there's different strains every single year. And if you get the flu 1 year, you can definitely get it the next year. That's not what I'm saying, but there's much more immunity, because once you get one strain, it's harder for you to get it the same strain the next year and whatnot. And plus we have a kind of a vaccine there that builds herd immunity. That's why we have, let's say, 20 million Americans every year on average get the flu. If we had no herd immunity whatsoever, then we'd have 200 million Americans. Actually, less than that, because the R0 value isn't as high. Because the R0 value for the flu is 1.28. So we wouldn't have to get up to near as high the level of infection for there to build herd immunity. And I'm spitballing here, but let's just say that I know at an R0 value of 3, which is most likely kind of the bottom of the cervasis sickness, you have to have a 60% herd immunity built. So that would mean right around 190 million Americans. But at a 1.2 R0 value, which is what the flu has, it'd be a lot lower than that. So call it 100 million or 80 million, something like that. Those two numbers make all the difference in the world. So you can fixate on the case fatality rate all you want and say, look, it's not higher than the flu. It's not higher than the flu. Great. You may be right. Okay. I hope it's not. I hope it's less, right? But it still, to a certain extent, doesn't matter because you've got 200 million people that need to get it. So work the numbers, reverse engineer the numbers, assuming that it's the flu, but just 200 million people get it instead of 20 million. And then ask yourself what that does to the capacity of the hospital system and what are the knock-on effects of that, right? So that's the key. My point is, even if you're, let's say you're a city or a country or a state, whatever, that flattens out the curve. Let's just say that you did a fantastic job. And I want to be clear. I'm not really in favor of a government lockdown. And I did a lot of media last week, just FYI here, guys. I did a lot of media last week. And I saw online a lot of these media outlets that they said that I said things that I didn't say. They didn't even take what I said out of context. They just simply said that I agreed with their narrative, and I never did. So if you guys ever see something online that says George Gammon said this, and it's not coming from georgegammon.com or my Twitter or my YouTube, and it sounds like, what? That doesn't sound like something George Gammon would say. Most likely, it's not something I said. They just invented it. So keep that in mind. And if you see anything like that, make sure you send it to me on Twitter so I can hopefully text the media outlet, say, hey guys, if you could please fix this, I would appreciate it. But my point is, if you get to a level, let's say there's just 500, let's say you've got a community of 500,000, 500 people get it, and then everyone does a great job washing their hands, masks on, social distancing, to where it just slowly starts going down, to where it goes from 500 to 400 to 300. And everyone says, okay, great, we've beat it. No more cervasis sickness. It's in the rearview mirror. Let's get everybody back to work so we can get the economy rolling again. And we don't have to worry about people paying their rent and all these things. Oh, thank goodness we beat the cervasis sickness. Okay, well, you have all those people go back. And what happens 3 weeks later? You're in the exact same spot because not enough people got it. It was only 500. And now there is an argument that that there could be a lot more Americans, obviously, because we're very limited on testing. Totally valid argument. Totally valid. But is it 200 million? I don't know. I would doubt that we're there yet, just all things considered. And so my point is, unless you were a community or a state or a city, country, that let's say you got flattened out the curve and it started to decline, then yes, everyone could go back to work if you completely walled off the community. So I mean, no flights, no cars, no one coming in from anywhere else. Because if you don't wall off your community, you're going to get a flight coming in from New York or from Washington or from Italy or Spain or wherever, and bam, it's going to bring it right back in, introduce it to the population that has not yet built herd immunity, and you're in the right in the same position. So I'm hoping I'm wrong. I'm hoping that there's a lot more people that have actually that have had this and just been through it, just thought it was like a normal cold, and we won't go through that. This kind of this double dip type thing. But then you have to ask yourself, what is immunity? Think about this. If you get the cervasis sickness and now let's say you have immunity, well, for how long, right? Immunity for the common cold, and that's a coronavirus, if I'm not mistaken, it's just a different strain, is like 3 or 4 months. So I'm hoping that if you get infected, then you're immune forever. That would be ideal, but it's not a certainty. It could be you're only immune 2 months, 3 months, or maybe you're not immune at all. Maybe you can get it and 2 weeks later get it again. All these are total game changers. And as of right now, we just don't know. So I think that yes, if you see communities open back up, it's good. I mean, Singapore did that, the same type of thing. Everyone's been looking at Singapore as kind of like the model of how to handle this. And obviously they've done a fantastic job, but even their government came out and said, listen, now we've started to see cases, they flattened it out, and then the cases started to go back up again when they became more laissez-faire. So now they're going to have to stop flights coming in, flights going out. They're going to have to take more of these types of measures. And I think you'll see the exact same thing in Sweden, and probably same thing in South Korea, probably same thing in China, although we know their numbers aren't real. So anyway, long way to answer a short question, but hopefully that makes sense. Scott, thank you for the super chat. Hey, George, gold up to 3,000. If yes, tentatively, when should I buy all gold? Let's see. When should I go all gold after saving rainy day buffer till I'm 60? I'm 32 now and outside the United States. Not sure I totally understand your question, Scott. Let's see. Should I go all gold? Oh, after saving like a rainy day fund, maybe is what you're saying? Until you turn, well, no, you shouldn't. If you're asking me if you should go all gold with your portfolio, the answer is 100% no. At least that's what I would do. I would never own 100% of anything. There's just no way. Life is too uncertain. If you're asking me, once you've saved enough money to have like a 6-month rainy day fund, which is pretty much the only idea of Dave Ramsey's that I like. Not that I like him. He's the one person that I'm not like that. I don't hold a grudge, or it's water off the duck's back. I could care less, but he's the one person that really gets under my skin. Anyway. So if you're asking me if once you have like a 6-month rainy day fund, then you should start accumulating gold as an insurance policy, I would say yes. If I'm doing it though, I'm not exceeding the 10% of my portfolio. Just to be very clear there. Cody, thank you for the super chat. Buying gold and silver still, following your advice on being patient with real estate. Okay, cool. Really feels like we are teetering point for big financial collapse. You could be right. Keep up the good work. Thanks, Cody, and I appreciate you being on the live stream every single week. Justin, thank you for the super chat. Reading some good news from China. Okay, awesome. That economy climbs again after reopening. After Europe, USA opens again, everybody wants to go out to restaurants, et cetera, right? And what do you think about housing market? Will it be affected? Well, Justin, I'm hoping I am wrong. And I'm concerned that once everything opens back up, we're going to see the curve start to decline. Then we're going to see an uptick and everyone's going to go right back. There's nothing I hate more than being locked up in this apartment now for almost 2 weeks. And I can't even imagine being here for another 2 weeks, let alone another month or maybe longer. But if I'm just looking at the math, that's kind of my base case. So, and I don't know that everyone's going to want to run out and to the restaurants. And I don't know that it's back to business as usual, Justin, because assuming this takes us 2 or 3 months, there's going to be so much damage done to the economy. And I want to be very clear, the damage to the economy was done long before the Cerveza sickness. The structural weakness and fundamental flaws in the economy were there, and they've just been getting worse and worse and worse and worse. It's just the Cerveza sickness was the catalyst to expose all of those fundamental flaws. So, and more specifically, the debt. So just because we go back to, call it normal, in 2 months, that doesn't mean that the economy's fixed. And think about all the businesses that go out of business because the only reason they are in business was because the excessive debt in the system. Well, they don't just open up the very next day, and those employees don't just get rehired immediately. So there's a lot of knock-on effects here. And the longer this goes on, the lower the likelihood that we go back to where we were 2 months ago. I just don't see that happening. But from an optimistic standpoint, is that a bad thing? One question I'd pose to all of you to ponder is, and this is something I threw out on Twitter as just kind of a thought experiment. A lot of people are saying, look, the damage to the economy, the cure for the virus is a lot worse than the virus itself. Okay, well, I can understand that because the unemployment rate is going to go sky high. All these businesses go bust. You look at this as just a total economic disaster. And they say, and even people on the right, left, it doesn't matter. They say, listen, we've got to stop this. We've got to do anything we can to cushion the blow here. But if we think about it, if we go back to 2008, do any of you think that if we wouldn't have inflated the everything bubble to paper over the housing bubble, would we be in a better place fundamentally now from an economic standpoint or a worse place? I think that almost everyone on the live stream right now would say, well, if we would have just taken the pain and not tried to paper over everything in 2008, and if we would not have blown up the everything bubble, if we would not have done quantitative easing infinity, if we let it just interest rates go where the market wants them to go, the economy would be on much stronger footing right now than it is. And we wouldn't be struggling as much from an economic standpoint. I'm not talking about the health. We wouldn't be struggling as much with the economy. Okay, well, if that's true, then do we really want to cushion the blow right now? Do we want to do that again where we try to kind of paper this over and not take as much pain as the economy wants us to take because it wants to get out and flush out the bad debts, the malinvestment? That's what it's doing right now. That's what it's trying to do. When, as you all know, the cure for the business cycle is a recession or sometimes even a depression. That's the cure. So why is it the cure? Because prices come down and we have actual price discovery, right? Think about all the millennials right now that are out there that can't afford a house. Well, we don't ever look at that side of it. We just look at it, the side of it from the people who actually own homes. Well, what about the people that want to buy homes? If prices go down by 50%, don't they benefit? If stocks go down by 50%, aren't there a lot of people that otherwise couldn't afford to get in the game? Don't they benefit? Right? So a recession is a very healthy thing. It's part of the process. So my point is, I don't know. I don't know if we should be thinking about the cerveza sickness. And again, I'm totally excluding the health stuff. But I don't know if we should be thinking about the economic effects as a bad thing long term, because let's just say we wouldn't have had the cerveza sickness. Then the everything bubble would have just got bigger, 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 bigger. And let's say the Fed would have kicked the can down the road until 2022 or 2025. Think about how big the bubbles would have been then. And as you guys know, at some point in time, the bubble's going to burst, right? So would we, and I know it seems like just inconceivable amounts of economic pain right now, but if this is the amount of pain that we're going through right now, where jobless claims are going to 6.6 million in a week, think about how bad it would be in 2023 when the debt is 10 times higher and the bubbles are 10 times worse, right? So I'm not saying one way or the other. I'm just throwing it out there as a thought experiment, and give me your opinion. You know, hit me up on Twitter later on today. Let me know what you think. If you're one of those people that believe that we should have taken the pain in 2008, we would have been a lot better now. Do you think we should just go ahead and take the pain now so we're better off in the future? I don't know. Jay-Z who for 12. Thank you for the super chat. George, if you lived in a $2 million home in San Francisco, owned it outright, would you try to take a mortgage out right now? And what would you do with the money? Ah, man, it really depends on how financially secure you are. And if you could, I'm going to assume that you make enough money and you're very, very confident that you're going to have your job still in a year. You've got a lot of savings, or maybe you make money online to where you're not dependent upon an employer. I'm just going to assume those things. And I'm going to assume that you have to, or because of your family or whatever reasons, that you don't want to move, that you want to stay there. I would do that. I would take out as much 30-year fixed rate debt right now as I possibly could. And I would wait. Even the interest that you're paying on it right now, I would just look at it as a way to, yeah. I was going to say maybe a line of credit. And then if you could, because I don't see interest rates going up very quickly in the near term. I'm just trying to think this through. So if you took out a line of credit on it, then you wouldn't have to put the money to work and you wouldn't be paying for the money. The problem is that if you've got an LOC and if you don't use it, if the bank is really struggling in 3 or 4 months, then they might say, okay, Jay-Z, sorry, no more line of credit for you. We're going to put the nix on that. See, I just hate to have you take out a mortgage term and then now you're on the hook and you're paying a lot of interest. Maybe I do half and half to be safe. Maybe I do half and half. I'm assuming you can get a 70% LTV. So that would give you, what, 1.4? Maybe I do 700 in a line of credit, 700 term it out, 30-year fixed rate. And then I'd keep that powder dry with the 700. And then as long as you got that, and then if things get super, super bad, you can use what you termed out and you have in the bank. And even if that line of credit gets cut off, you're still okay. But if you can't find anything to buy, you're not on the hook for so much in carrying costs in the form of interest before you kind of throw in the towel and pay back the loan. That's probably what I'd do if it were me. But to be clear, I wouldn't take even the 700 you term out. I wouldn't take that and just go feel as though you have to rush in and buy something. That's what I'd avoid. You're like, oh shoot, I've got this 700. I gotta buy something now because I've got all these carrying costs in the form of my mortgage payment, my interest. I'd really try to avoid that. Darren, thank you for the super chat. Hi, George, thanks for the super chats. First rule of investing, don't fight the Fed. Right. Well, I don't know if that's the first rule, but I think that's a good thought for sure. Where will all the liquidity go? That is where the opportunity will be. Fund flows. And this is an international tidal wave. It is. Where will all the liquidity go? Well, there's going to be a lot. Well, first and foremost, there's a lot less. There most likely will be a lot less purchasing power moving forward, because if you have a, well, I won't go into that, but that's going to take us a long time here. But where will liquidity go? You got to look at the dollar for foreigners. They're going to go into cash. I'm just trying to think, if I was a foreigner, what would I do? I'd buy gold. Whew, I could not buy gold fast enough. Shoot, sorry guys, I lost it here. I think it's going to go into gold, not now, but over the next, after a year or so. How can it not go into gold? And I think it'll also go into real estate. Maybe not in the United States, maybe not in the developed countries, but maybe like in Colombia or in a less developed country where they don't have a lot of debt in the system. That's their hedge, is they just take all their money and throw it into real estate. So I'd look at real estate in some of the underdeveloped countries and gold. I think that's where it's going to flow. But where everything's going to go, I don't know. And I think there's people are going to take a lot of haircuts. So I don't know that there's going to be as much purchasing power, a lot of debt destruction. But I think short term, most likely the dollar. It's tough to see the dollar go down against other currencies in the short term. Zoomer, thank you for the super chat. Thank you, George, for the great service of education. You should run a course on securities analysis. No, I should not. No. And central banks, or minimum, please write a book. So securities analysis, guys, I'm not into securities analysis. Not that I'm not into it, but I admit I do not know as much as I should about securities analysis. When it comes to central banks or how the economy works, I think I can pretty much hold my own there. And I'd probably admit hesitantly, as you can see, I probably would admit that when it comes to macro and understanding central banks and how the plumbing works and the repo market and all these things, I do know quite a bit about that. I know enough about that to where I'm confident enough doing whiteboard videos explaining it. As far as securities analysis, I don't know enough about it to where I'd be confident explaining that to another person. I'm trying to learn myself. And that's why I'm doing things like the educational series with Patrick Serezna on options. A ton of people have been emailing Sebastian asking him when we're coming out with episode 4. We're shooting that next week. So hopefully that'll come out next week. And then we're going to do kind of like a workshop where everyone can tune in and watch Patrick trade options in real time in the real markets. And I'm going to be there as a student, just trying to absorb as much as I can. So I just want to be specific on kind of what my strengths are and what my weaknesses are. But the cool thing about my weaknesses is I'm anything I learn, I always try to make sure that I'm taking you guys along with me on that journey. So I think sometimes that's even more powerful than me coming in and saying, okay, here's how the repo market works. Bam, 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 bam. Okay, you get that. But if I'm like, okay, I have no idea really how options work, let's get Patrick Serezna in here and let's have him teach me, and you guys can walk through the entire journey. I think it might even be more powerful from an educational standpoint. At least that's what I'm hoping. So I'm going to be doing a lot of content with the stuff that I do know a lot about. But I'm also going to be doing a lot of content with the stuff I'm trying to learn. Hopefully that'll be as valuable. William, thank you for the super chat. Okay, now a couple I missed here. Grand finale. Thank you for the super chat. Are you concerned with subprime CLOs? Yeah. Yeah. Sure. I'm concerned with all those types of derivatives. I mean, for sure. But I think the Fed is going to come in and buy them all. I don't know if we're going to have a situation like 2008 from that standpoint, because they have the playbook. In their minds, it's pretty simple. You just create all the funny money and just take all the mortgage-backed sausages in whatever form and buy them all. So, because if a derivative is on the Fed's balance sheet, and let's say that it goes down in value by 99%, Fed doesn't care. Fed doesn't have a P&L, and so technically it wouldn't really affect the economy, or it wouldn't affect the profitability of the pension funds, the banks, the financial institutions. You see what I'm saying? It's like, well, I don't want to go back to that Dave and Buster's because I don't want to overcomplicate things. But I think you guys understand what I'm saying. If the Fed owns the entire bond market, as an example, they're never going to sell. And if let's say you own a bond, the one that hasn't been sold to the Fed, you don't really have to worry too much about the bond price dropping or the interest rate going up or anything like that, because the Fed owns everything. And if they're not selling, you don't really have a market. It's a very weird, it's tough to get your head around, because we've got to introduce ourselves to the concept of there not being a market. There's no market for derivatives. There's no market for maybe equities. I don't know. There's no market. I mean, look at Japan. There's no market for JGBs because there's no buyers. There's no sellers because the government owns a good majority of them, or the central bank. So hopefully that explains. Yes, I'm worried about them, but I think the sooner or later, they're going to be on the Fed's balance sheet. Neurosurgery. Highland, thank you for the super chat. 14% of yearly flu cases are from the Cerveza, okay? This is cyclical, ending in April, despite scientific yet simplistic assumptions. Just a comment, okay? Yeah, I mean, I think really the takeaway is we just don't know. We don't know. And I kind of piss off everyone. In my opinion of this, and that I don't know, I hate to have the government come in and tell you you can or can't do something. Oh boy, that is a slippery slope. So I understand that from a health standpoint, ideally the government would come in and just bam, lockdown. But because the window of opportunity that opens for the government longer term to take away our liberties. And I mean, my gosh, you could go on and on about that. In addition to, if there is an argument for, not taking such an economic blow, we discussed that earlier. I'll leave that up to you guys to decide in your own mind. But it's just, I think my standpoint is I hate to see the government coming into it. I just wish they would have been honest up front and given the people the data. Right. Remember back, a month ago, 2 months ago, where the CDC was coming out and saying that masks don't work. Not only do they not work, they're counterproductive. They actually do more bad than good. Like what? Like why are we doing this? I mean, I get it that they didn't have enough for the medical community, but don't you think a better function of the government or better decision back in January? When guys like Townsend and Chris Martinson, and even I did a video on it in late January. If I know something or if I'm suspicious of something, don't you think the United States government should kind of be on top of that? Don't you think they should have said, okay, well, let's just take maybe some money and buy some masks just so we've got them just in case. What's our downside there? So I just wish they would have been more honest and given all the data. I know there's data out there that would suggest that there's a lot more people that have it. And as far as the case fatality rate, it's much more like the flu. Fantastic. But let's just get all the information out there so people can make decisions. And let's encourage, and I'm talking about the government, let's encourage people to wear masks. Let's encourage people to practice social distancing, wash their hands, do all these things. Because what's our downside to that, right? Even if this is going to pass and we're all going to say, oh man, how stupid we were for worrying about the Cerveza sickness. Okay, fine. So you've got the population goes out, kind of looks stupid for a couple months wearing face masks, and they've got some dry hands because they're just obsessively using soap and antibacterial gel or whatever. And maybe you don't go to some bars. Maybe you don't go out drinking as much. Go to some movies for a couple months. What's your downside there, right? I mean, so that's I piss off everyone in the standpoint of I don't like the government doing it, but I wish that people would have maybe taken upon themselves with the proper data to take more precautionary measures. So anyway, that's just my opinion. But I think the main takeaway here is, guys, we just don't know. We don't know what the case fatality rate is going to end up with. We don't know what percentage of the population has it. These are all just complete unknowns. Baron, thank you for the super chat. How did you become so knowledgeable on the Fed and central banks? Baron, it's kind of my personality, buddy. And it's got its strengths. It's got its drawbacks for sure. And that when I get interested in something and fixated, I am absolutely obsessive about it. Like it's to a standpoint of it, it's probably not healthy. And back in 2012, when I retired, I got into macro, and since then it's just been an obsession. And every time, even when I'm not doing videos, guys, this is the honest truth. You can ask Sebastian, you can ask anybody. As soon as I get done filming the videos, I'm listening to podcasts. I'm listening to Macro Voices. I'm listening to Real Vision. I'm watching YouTube videos. I'm trying to learn more. It's just, it's nonstop. Even when I go to bed at night, all I'm listening to podcasts, or I'm studying macro. If I'm in the shower, I'm sitting there, I've got my phone, and it's outside on the countertop, and I'm playing the latest, Jim Grant podcast or something. Before the Cerveza sickness, if I'd go to the country club where I'm a member and play golf, I'd have my headphones in and I'd be listening to macro podcasts. That's how I can do it. But I've always been like that. I've always been like that. Whatever I sink my teeth into, I tend to learn more about it in like a month than most people learn in like 5 years. Because I just do it 24/7. So AF Visions, thank you for the super chat. Great truck deals right now. Yeah, you got it. 0% interest. Oh no, you're talking about I thought you were going a different direction there. Okay. I thought you were talking about the old school Power Strokes, the ones that I like to buy as a store of value. Great truck deals right now. 0% interest for 84 months on no payments for 1 year. Yeah, but is that great or is that horrible? Get a new truck at fixed rate with dollars strong. Oh, no. Similar to 30. No. Because you're buying a depreciating asset. That thing's going to drop 60% in value the moment you drive it off the lot. What are you talking? No. Now, if you could do that same deal, where you could have 84 months, no payments, fixed rate at a super low rate, and buy a 1997 F-250 extended cab Power Stroke 7.3 diesel with 80,000 miles on it. Yeah, then I'd do it. But you're comparing apples to oranges here. I think you're just trying to give yourself an excuse to go out and buy that brand new truck that you've been salivating over for the last 6 months or so. I'm not going to back that one. I can't give that the green light. But thank you for the super chat. Guys, thanks for joining me on a Sunday. If you want to check out Chris's interviews, I'd strongly suggest that. And that's Chris McIntosh, and it's part 1 and 2, I believe. But if you scroll through the videos, you'll see it. All right, guys, enjoy your day, and I will see you on the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.